From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! White supremacist convicted of hate attack in Florida, another arraigned in California. Today, a look at members of the World Church of the Creator, a white supremacist group, and the high-stakes battle to control high-speed internet lines now focused in San Francisco. A look also at the lawsuits around guns as a result of the Atlanta shooting. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Atlanta's mayor says they may never know all the reasons behind the rampage yesterday that left 13 people dead and a dozen injured. Mayor Bill Campbell said his main concern now is trying to bring his city back together. Police say shooter Mark Barton killed himself after they tried to arrest him for shooting 9 people to death at 2 brokerage firms. Investigators later found the bludgeoned bodies of his wife and 2 children in their home. Police say he was apparently angry about his stock market losses. Campbell was hesitant to discuss notes left with the bodies of his family. Police have not disclosed their contents except to say that they had found a list indicating Barton had intended to kill at least 3 more people. He is also suspected of having killed a previous wife and his mother years ago. We'll have more on that story later in the show, particularly focusing on gun lawsuits and Atlanta being one of a couple of dozen cities in this country that are suing gun manufacturers. This news from Bosnia-Herzegovina, the Yugoslav Republic of Montenegro will begin steps towards secession from Yugoslavia unless sweeping legal changes are made in the next few weeks. This according to the Montenegrin foreign minister today. The United States supports Montenegro's pro-Western president, Milo Djukanovic, but has urged him to avoid an open break to prevent further instability in the Balkans. Milosevic, the Yugoslav president, is unlikely to accept any fundamental change in the relationship between the 2 remaining Yugoslav republics, which would weaken his power. He rejected similar proposals from Slovenia and Croatia before they broke with Yugoslavia in 1991. Djukanovic said in an interview that Montenegro has already taken major steps to become closer to Western Europe, including changes in its monetary policy, trade, taxes, and security. This news from Moscow. Russia must rebuild close relations with the West that were hurt by the Yugoslav crisis, says President Boris Yeltsin. Russia strongly opposed NATO's air campaign against Yugoslavia, but helped negotiate a peaceful settlement and sent its peacekeepers to take part in the NATO-led peacekeeping mission in Kosovo. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Sergei Stepashin left for a summit today in Sarajevo, Bosnia, which is to discuss development and security in the Balkans. The conference, attended by leaders of nearly 40 nations, including President Clinton, is intended to underscore the isolation of Serbia as long as President Milosevic holds power. The U.S. and other Western nations have said they will only provide limited humanitarian assistance to Yugoslavia as long as Milosevic is in power. Moscow, meanwhile, is pushing for a broader aid package to include Serbia. Russia has promised to supply Yugoslavia with $150 million worth of goods this winter. Brazil's truckers agreed today to end a 4-day strike that had paralyzed the country after the government promised to suspend a planned hike in road tolls. The deal, which was reached after 2 days of talks, included government pledges to step up security on Brazil's roads and better maintain federal highways. The strike involving thousands of truckers caused severe food and gas shortages across Brazil, which is heavily dependent on trucks to transport about 60% of its cargo. And finally, the House voted early yesterday to withhold recruitment money for the Army School of the Americas, a facility long criticized for training Latin American officers who turned out to be tyrants and murderers. The vote came as an amendment to the $12.7 billion foreign aid bill, which the House began debating last night. The House adjourned after midnight, postponing until Monday a final vote on the bill, which would slash nearly $2 billion from the White House's request, including $500 million aimed at furthering peace in the Middle East. School of the Americans graduates include General Manuel Noriega, as well as Roberto Daubison, reputed death squad commander and political leader in El Salvador, and dozens of soldiers accused of political killings in El Salvador and Peru. The vote, 230 to 197. We're joined on the phone right now by Carol Richardson of the School of the Americas Watch, SOA Watch in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carol.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your response to this vote that took place in the last hours.
Well, I tell you, we knew that we had a chance to win, you know, as we were counting votes yesterday, but never in our wildest imagination did we think that we'd win this big. I mean, all of the Pentagon's high-powered lobbying could not, in the end, drown out the voice of the people around the country who have been speaking out for the voiceless, you know, trying to shut down the School of the Americas, and we are just so grateful to all of those around the country that have done so much work, and certainly to the members of Congress who stepped forward to do the right thing.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Again, this last news headline, in the last few hours, the House voted to trim funds for School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. On the phone with us, Carol Richardson of School of the Americas Watch, based in Washington, D.C. The actual SOA Watch is right outside of Fort Benning, Georgia. Carol Richardson, though, what exactly does this mean? School doesn't close.
No, it does not. But it's an astounding victory. It is the first time after several years of votes, it is the first time that the Congress has ever voted to cut funds for the School of the Americas. Now, of course, it will need to go, you know, to the conference committee at this point. But we are going into the conference committee with the Senate, you know, in a very, very strong position, you know, having won by a 33-vote victory and having very strong bipartisan support. I mean, there were 58 Republicans who voted along with 171 Democrats, you know, to bring us to this 230 figure. Now, it's important to remember, too, that alongside of this particular effort, there is also a freestanding bill, H.R. 732, which was offered by Representative Joseph Moakley. And we, at this point, have 151 co-sponsors on that bill. And that bill is just a straight close the School of the Americas. And we will continue, you know, to work to get a vote on that bill as well.
Carol Richardson of SOA Watch in Washington, D.C., if people want to contact your organization, where can they call or go on the web?
They can call area code 202-234-3440, or they can contact us through our webpage on www.soaw.org.
That's www.soaw.org. Thank you, Carol Richardson.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move quickly on now to another story. Two brothers suspected of shooting a gay couple to death and setting fire to synagogues have pleaded innocent to murder charges in Redding, California. Benjamin Williams and James Williams, 31 and 29 years old, have been held without bail since their arrest July 7th. Prosecutors have not decided whether to seek the death penalty. The brothers, who entered their pleas yesterday, are accused of shooting Gary Mattson and Winfield Motor, who were found in their bed July 1st in rural Happy Valley, about 165 miles north of Sacramento. Evidence found in the brothers' homes also links them to June arson fires that caused $1 million in damages at three Sacramento area synagogues. No charges have been filed in the fires. Authorities also found handouts from the World Church of the Creator, an Illinois-based white supremacist group. Meanwhile, in Florida, we are also looking at the case of an indictment of a conviction yesterday in Florida of a white supremacist also connected to the World Church of the Creator. That case involved some skinheads beating up a Cuban man named William Salas, who was trying to protect his son from a beating. While they were acquitted, in this case, one of the skinheads acquitted of the beating of the son, they were convicted of the beating of the father. We're joined right now by several people to talk about these cases and their possible connection, and that is through the church that they both say that they are part of, the skinheads, the World Church of the Creator. We're joined on the telephone by Mark Potok of the Intelligence Report of Clan Watch, based at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And we're joined also by a gentleman from Texas, and we'll talk about another case with him in just a minute. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark Potok.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about what these two stories are and their connection?
Sure. I don't think there is a connection, to put it simply. It is true that in the Williams brothers' home in Redding, California, some World Church of the Creator literature was found. Really, what it was printouts of websites, but so was a great deal of other literature. And it's become quite clear that these two brothers, particularly the older one, were adherents of Christian identity, virulently racist and anti-Semitic religion, but a religion that is nevertheless based on a kind of aberrant reading of the Bible. The World Church of the Creator, on the other hand, which is clearly linked to the shootings in Chicago and Indiana over the Independence Day weekend, is desperately anti-Christian. It is a neo-Nazi group that, in fact, believes all religions are hocus-pocus, are Jewish plots to crush white people and that sort of thing. So I don't think there's any connection whatsoever, other than the fact that the Williams brothers took these pages down.
We are joined on the telephone as well by Al Weisberg, who is one of the founders of Temple Beth Israel and a member of the Shasta County Citizens Against Racism in Redding, California. I was wondering, Mr. Weisberg, if you could talk about what the conversation is that's going on and the activities that are happening around the case of the gay couple who was killed and the arraignment of the two brothers suspected of their shooting.
Well, as I explained to your interviewer, Redding is not a hate-ridden community. We're a community of about 80,000, I think that we've had positive feelings among groups in the community, so this particular crime was a great shock. We really had nothing of this nature. We've had dissemination of hate literature at various times, and in every instance, members of mainline groups joined forces to say, this does not represent us, and it was cut off. In this particular instance, we have an unusually shocking crime. Gary Madsen, particularly, was well known in the community. He was a horticulturist. He and his former wife were the founders of the major science museum here, and he was the instigator of a beautiful arboretum, which is part of a museum complex in the area. And his partner was also a very well-liked man who worked for a local store in their horticulture department. It was a shocking crime, and a large memorial service was held in the park adjacent to the Science Museum, our main local park, which there was a tremendous outpouring of public sentiment. It was very, very moving. I was particularly moved because I had conducted a service in exactly that same place for an educator who had been one of the founders of the Science Museum. And while that was a very lovely event, this was striking because so many people came together who were shocked by the crime and united by their affection for the two men, regardless of their sexual orientation. Then there was a meeting of various groups, including SCAR, the Citizens Against Racism, which planned a rally in our downtown mall, which took place. It was a week after the murders, a rally for tolerance, unity, and racial harmony, which half a dozen people representing various groups, including the gay community, spoke, and then we had audience. There were several hundred people there, and it was a very moving event. I mentioned to your interviewer that we had a woman minister who spoke eloquently, and if you have the time, I would just read a single paragraph from her remarks. Is that appropriate here?
Yes.
Okay. She said, "Every life is sacred. Each human being on this earth is precious to God. When anyone's life is cut short, it is a tragedy and a loss to the human family. But when a person is murdered because of their beliefs, of their ethnicity, or their sexual orientation, it is more than a loss. It is an assault on our common humanity." And I think that was an eloquent statement of a feeling which people, by and large, have had.
You're listening to Al Weisberg, who is from Redding, California, where two gay men were killed, and now the men suspected of shooting them have been arraigned. This has just taken place yesterday, and Al Weisberg is with the Shasta County Citizens Against Racism. Mark Potok, editor of Intelligence Report of Klan Watch. The other case in Florida, the case of William Salas being beaten and the conviction yesterday of a white supremacist involved in his beating. Could you talk more specifically about that case in Fort Lauderdale?
Well, I think what the case shows, among other things, is that the World Church of the Creator is, in fact, a very violent group. The leader of this group, a kid who recently got his law degree, Matt Hale, in Illinois, spent a lot of time on national television in the last few weeks going on about how his was not a violent group and so on, as reporters came running to him after a shooting spree that took place in Chicago and Indiana. In fact, the World Church of the Creator, leaders of this group have been responsible for the murder of a black man in Florida, for shooting up an occupied car in Georgia, for robbing banks in Ohio, for blowing up an NAACP office in Washington. And then these latest cases in Florida, there have been really quite a series of them, and I think it really exemplifies what this group is all about. While Hale claims that his is a call for nonviolent revolution, as it were, in fact, the motto of this group is RAHOA. That's a kind of battle cry, and it is short for racial holy war. You know, when you look into the writings of this group, it's patently violent in its talk. And as I say, in fact, they have left over the last 26 years a real trail of blood across this country, the latest incidents being in Florida. You know, and this was not merely some skinhead follower of the World Church of the Creator who was convicted yesterday. This was the state, the Florida state leader, a man named Jules Fetu.
I want to talk about another case that we're just beginning to learn about in Emory, Texas. Now, it doesn't involve the particular hate group that seems to be implicated in these two cases in Florida and California. But it is a case that's just emerging that sounds frighteningly reminiscent of another case that we all know about in eastern Texas and Jasper, the case of James Byrd. This is a case in eastern Texas, in Emory, Texas. Authorities aren't sure whether the killing of H.W. Walker, an African-American man allegedly tied to a tree and burned by a white teenager, is a hate crime. Walker's family believes it is, and so does the NAACP, which has persuaded federal authorities to investigate. But to some of the 1,000 people living in Emory, a hate crime designation doesn't make any difference. Walker was reported missing in early May, and his charred remains were discovered on June 2nd. A 16-year-old suspect was arrested the next day and remained in custody yesterday. NAACP officials believe the young man had ties to an area hate group called the Day Walkers, but authorities also are investigating whether Walker was killed for money. He had just cashed a Social Security check. When we come back, we're going to be joined by one of the officials of the NAACP in Texas to talk about this emerging case and why he is pushing for it to be investigated as a hate crime, what evidence he's gathered. Then we're going to hear from a religious leader on the issue of racism. We'll hear from the Reverend James Forbes, who is head of one of the largest churches in New York, the Riverside Church. After that, we're going to look at the Atlanta shooting that took place yesterday, the rampage that killed at least 9 people. And finally, we're going to look at high-speed internet connections and why a corporate war is taking place over them. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Just having referred to the case in Emory, Texas, or in Eastern Texas, that is just beginning to take shape around the country as we hear NAACP officials calling for an investigation of the death of a man named H.W. Walker, an African-American man who may have been tied to a tree and burned by a white teenager. The question is, was it a hate crime? We're joined on the telephone right now by Bill Glenn, who is Texas State Regional Representative of the NAACP. And he is calling for an investigation into H.W. Walker's death. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Glenn.
Good morning.
Can you describe for us what you see as the facts of this case so far that you have actually taken a lead in investigating beyond what the police had originally done?
Well, there's always some reluctance to, let me make this clear. The white citizens of that area want the victim, want the culprits punished. And I truly believe that, given my interaction with them. Now, having said that, they are also reluctant to label it a hate crime because no one wants their community associated with such a thing. H.W. Walker lived in Greenville, Texas. Greenville, Texas is in Hunt County, and so is Lone Oak, where H.W. Walker lived before moving to Greenville. H.W. Walker had a young man in Lone Oak that he knew on a first-name basis that would come to Greenville and pick him up to catch a Social Security check each month. And so was the case in May. The bank has film to show that he did cash his check, that the young man was with him. And that was about noon, but after 1 o'clock, no one saw H.W. Walker again. He was last seen with this young man. And after that, the family reported him missing. And he was missing for a month. Well, now, the young man is allegedly were taking friends to show him this deed he'd done. And one young man panicked and went and told the mayor of the small town of Lone Oak. The body was found in another county, the adjacent county. And that's where the jurisdiction is, so we've got a lot of places involved. But at any rate, the young man, 16-year-old, is being held. Now, almost all parties, agree that it took more than one person. H.W. Walker was a pretty good-sized man, and the young man is very slight. And so the white citizens of that community kept asking us, when are they going to pick the other guy? When are they going to pick the other one up? And so the NAACP conducted their own investigation because the official investigation apparently had stopped. They were satisfied with this one young man. And we felt that that was an attempt to hide the fact that it was a hate crime. That's where we got. Now, we know of a number of young men down there, and I think they're loosely put together, pretty loose. I don't think they are a hard and fast group, but they are capable of random acts like this, and the atmosphere exists for hate crime to happen. And so that's we went to the NAACP. The U.S. Attorney. With the information we had gathered, and they felt it was enough for them to get involved. And so we're pleased with that at this point.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow your case. And I wanted to get a final comment from Mark Potok, editor of Intelligence Report of Clan Watch. Whether this is an organized group, Mark Potok, that we're beginning to see emerge in eastern Texas, or just a club of young white supremacists, how does that fit into this larger picture you follow around the country? I was asking that question to Mark Potok, who is no longer with us. But, I want to thank you very much, Bill Glenn, for being with us from Texas. Again, we'll follow your case. And also a thank you to Al Weisberg, founder of the Temple Beth-El Synagogue in California, member of the Shasta County Citizens Against Racism, who's organizing against racism and anti-Semitism and against white supremacy in California. All cases we will continue to follow. Right now, we thought we would conclude this segment with the words of the Reverend James Forbes. James Forbes, who gave a speech recently at Columbia University. His remarks part of a conference convened by Columbia Professor Manning Marable entitled Black America versus the Prison Industrial Complex. Reverend Forbes.
I have revised the title for the for this session. The way it is written now for me is Death, the Penalty for Being Black. That's the framework. I am here still remembering the recital of how things were getting better through hard struggle. And Leon Higginbotham, before he died, talked about, is it Yogi Berra, deja vu all over again, saying for all of the gains that he saw a trend right on back down to where we started from. And then he told something about an African mamelari that he saw in Nigeria, on which it was printed, no time for foolishness. And I suspect had he lived, he would have enfleshed that. Y'all, we have no time for foolishness about the issues which are before us. Here I am now, 1999. My mind flashes back to the South, where I grew up. The time is January 10th, 1961. And at that age, I bought my first meal, I think, at Woolworth, sat down at the counter at Woolworth, because before that, being black, you could purchase it out of the window, but you couldn't sit down. And when I sat down, since some people had started marching in Greensboro, and now it was against the law for them to deny us the opportunity to sit and eat, what we are talking about today was manifested right there. Because as soon as I sat down, the white woman who was sitting next to where I sat down, though she had just been given her meal, immediately got up and ran out. I went home so touched by that that I recall even now writing back at home, hurt. I do not even now know whether I ever bought my hot dog with mustard and ketchup and relish and a big orange, because I sat down and I wrote, why did she move when I sat down? Surely she could not tell so soon that my Saturday bath had worn away or that savage passion had pushed me for a rape. Perhaps it was the cash she carried in her purse. She could not risk a theft so early in the month. And who knows that on tomorrow 'twould fall her lot to drink her coffee from a cup my darkened hands had clutched. So horrible was that moment, I too should have run away. For prejudice has the odor of a dying beast, Whether rapist or racist, both fall in the savage class. And the greatest theft of all is to rob one's right to be. That's what I wrote in that time. But that next year, I was sitting at Union Seminary across the street in a course being taught by George Kelsey, who passed a few years ago. The course was about his book entitled Christianity or Racism and the Christian Understanding of Man. That was the way they wrote it in those days, in which he said, the logic of racism is genocide.
Right. Yeah.
Does not mean that just by being black, you're going to die right off. But if the logic at the heart of racism is followed, and in difficult times, it will become exacerbated, the problematics, that it's genocide. And here's what he said it was. That people raise the issue of race to ontological status. It is the view, as reflected in white supremacist understanding, that whatever God was making in the cookie shop, that a batch of the cookies were spoiled and were burned, and these burned cookies, a language about race, are clearly not going to be fit to put on the table, so that the logic is to cast those out. Let me be more specific. That is that the ontological affirmation of the closeness of whiteness to godliness and the corresponding assertion that blackness is the opposite of godliness makes it possible to feel and think that one is actually doing God a favor to participate in the elimination of the defective form of humanity which blackness is. This understanding, coupled with what is now obvious, that being white actually carries with it certain privileges which suggest that the white brand of humanity is clearly the definitive form next to the Creator, such that whites themselves, being so close to the Creator, can participate in the denigration of the significance and the worth of black presence. And, by the way, the purpose here is not to offend. The purpose is to recruit. And the reason why I'm saying it as I am saying it is that out of a notion that whiteness is of a higher value than the other forms of human existence, a whole system to enact the faith claim of the superiority and the priority and the power deserving quality and the controlling mechanisms of white gives all sorts of mechanisms operating all the time. It just so happens today that we're talking about the death penalty. And I am saying that the death penalty, as it operates in America, may really be applying to criminals all over the place, but the way it functions, it is an instrument for living out the theology of the supremacy of whiteness along with God, who is also white. The issue of racism is so volatile when you even name it that sometimes people even have to apologize for having called people racist. But the better term I understand is tribalism. And that connects with the second item that I want to mention, that it was Eric Fromm who used the word tribalism as a better way of getting at it, to say that there comes a time when people are suspicious of those who are not of their own tribe. Persons who have not eaten the same food, have not played the same music, have not spoken the same language, are viewed as in some way threat, which gets me to the heart of what I want to say today. The most serious issue in America today, so far as I can see, is what I have come to call insecurity-itis. That is to say, there is an epidemic spread of insecurity. Poor people, in the light of the welfare reform bill, think nobody cares for them. Rich folks, in the light of the market that keeps on galloping and galloping, and they know that there's a curve, and it ain't bell curve here, that bull will turn to bear sooner or later, and the ones who are at the top are insecure. When will the tremor actually be an earthquake of seismic levels 6, 7, and 8? And the middle folks think they're being squeezed. But fundamentally, let me say it this way. I do not yet fully understand it. But something is happening in white America that carries with it such a fundamental insecurity about the capacity to sustain the hegemony and the power and the control that used to be the case, that it is now necessary to reinforce the walls which separate them and protect them behind gated communities on many different levels. And it results in the erosion of affirmative action, the celebration of finally getting the welfare queen off the roll, of letting job situations begin to be much more racialistic in terms of the assignment of power. And it's a deep thing. The way I test it out is, in many settings, I ask folks who are black to say, black is beautiful. And I'll ask you that. Everybody who's black, say, black is beautiful.
Black is beautiful.
Now I want to ask the white people, say, white is beautiful.
Black.
No, white, no. Now, let me say it this way. In a society where it is for some reason difficult for whites to celebrate their humanity under the rubric of their whiteness, you will expect that every instrument of social arrangements will have some tendency to reflect that either we would have to make a decision that we're going to live with folks that are not like us, or we will consent, even if we are not the absolute perpetrators, to the steady erosion of the capacity of the other to generate power that people will have to deal with. Therefore, the death penalty is a funny thing. Decent people, both black and white, have to make up their minds whether they are going to be willing to use a mechanism which inadvertently will reflect the desire for the power and the control of one group of people and the steady erosion of the power on the way to the elimination of the other. No, we know that that's ludicrous, except the ludicrous is increasingly beginning to be what we observe on every hand. So now, let me see if within the time frame that I have left, I can put it this way. I think this is the best way to put it. Black and white people who do not want to use instruments that are clearly perpetuators of the sense of the supremacy of some people over against the other, and black and white people who are not any longer confident that they will be more secure as they quarantine themselves within the power arenas of their own making, have to make up their minds, because the culture is saying steadily that if white people want to be in charge of things, they had better get together and begin to close the door. And there are blacks who also at times buy into the same ideology. And to be together and to be a society that's deciding that we're going to be black and white and Latin and Asian and Hispanic, and we're going to do that together, you can no longer assume that that is Americanism. That choice has to be made all over again, and for that reason, the issue of the death penalty provides a good place to begin. To decide that we, in the light of all of the data that's been spoken here, that we want to live together, we want to work on the social and human problems we've got, and we want to do it together, and that the future of America is likely to be better served by somehow learning the difficult lessons of collaboration across lines of class and race and religion, if you believe that together holds a better prospect for us than apart, then the death penalty provides an excellent way to say, maybe we ought to consider that that death penalty does not provide the security that it promises, and that a greater prospect will come if we, first of all, decide no more death penalties until we can get somebody qualified to execute it. That is to say, no more death penalties until somebody is qualified that I am no longer willing to use the instruments of state, and we use murder, but in all fields, of state killing, because the people who do it have not passed the human sensitivity test. And if they don't prove that they could do it justly, the chances are it shouldn't be done at all. Let's work on other methods. And I really want to say this closing. My final remarks are humorous, and I might call my bird story. It's the story of a soldier in a far-off region, tropical region, wanted to send his mother a gift. The gift he saw in the shop was that he could send this tropical bird, and they could have it shipped in such a way to get to his mother. So the mother received the bird, and the son called and said, son, the son called, did you get the gift? She said, son, I got the gift. And the son says, did you like it? She said, yes, the bird was delicious, just delicious. And the mother, and the son said, Mom, that was a talking bird. You're not supposed to eat him. Said the man said that this bird actually could speak 4 different languages. And the mama said, well, he should have said something. Now, I challenge you, brothers and sisters, either you are for togetherness or you are for apartheid. And if you are for togetherness, when it comes to the death penalty, you should have said something.
And you've been listening to the Reverend James Forbes of the Riverside Church giving a speech recently at Columbia University in New York. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. When we come back, a look at lawsuits that cities have brought around the country against gun manufacturers. This in the wake of the rampage that took place yesterday in Atlanta. 9 people at least dead. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Securities Day trader killed 9 people yesterday afternoon in 2 office buildings in Atlanta's glitzy Buckhead District. He eluded an extensive police manhunt for 5 hours, then killed himself in his van after the police pulled him over in nearby Cobb County. An additional 12 people were injured in the incident, 7 from gunshot wounds. When police went to his house, they found his wife's body and his 2 children. Also, questions are now being raised about whether the shooter, Mark Barton, also killed his previous wife and his mother. We're going to take a look right now at what is going on in Atlanta, not specifically about the shooting that took place yesterday, but about the fact that Atlanta is one of more than two dozen cities that are involved in a number of lawsuits against gun manufacturers in the country. We're joined right now by Paul Barrett, who has been following these city lawsuits for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Paul.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's good to be with you, though not good news we're getting out of Atlanta. Can you talk about what the Atlanta lawsuit is about?
Sure. Atlanta, interestingly, right in the middle of the biggest annual gun industry trade show back earlier in February, sued the gun industry, claiming that the industry should be held responsible for the costs, the public costs of gun violence on the streets of Atlanta, because it had failed, the various companies that manufacture guns had failed to use available technology to make guns safer, such as technology that purportedly can limit the use of guns just to a particular authorized user. And Atlanta, now joined by about two dozen other cities and counties around the country, as well as the NAACP, is trying to hold the gun industry accountable for the criminal use of the gun industry's products.
Do you think that this lawsuit in Atlanta could prevent something like what we saw yesterday take place?
Well, that's a good question, and to get a little bit more specific about the lawsuit talks a great deal about unauthorized use of guns. It focuses heavily on children and teenagers getting a hold of guns, which it's obviously by definition illegal for them to be using, and shooting each other, and the fact that the gun companies, according to the Atlanta and according to gun foes, could make guns safer so that only the people who properly should own and use the guns use them. I think it's probably fair to say that whole line of attack on the gun industry is pretty much irrelevant to this case, because I think we can safely presume that this man who was in his 40s could have gotten a hold of these guns legally and could have, even if there were some type of safety mechanism on them, could have disabled that safety mechanism. So that line of attack with these lawsuits, at first glance, given what we know right now, doesn't seem to have much to do with this type of shooting. It would have more to do, I would say, with the sorts of school shootings that we've seen over the last couple of years, where kids are getting at guns that they're not supposed to have.
Finally, Paul, in Washington, legislation, how does it relate to the city lawsuits? We've heard Republicans and Democrats battling over gun control. Where does that stand now?
The Senate a couple months ago passed several modest gun control provisions. The House failed to pass comparable provisions. These were added to a so-called juvenile justice bill that is pending. The Senate has now named conferees or negotiators who will be joined by negotiators from the House to see whether in the final version of the bill some gun provisions will be added. I think one line of analysis would lead you to the conclusion that with this latest massacre, there would be renewed pressure for Congress as a whole to pass some type of gun legislation. However, there was an awful lot of pressure immediately in the wake of the Colorado school shooting, and the House of Representatives didn't pass gun control legislation then. The whole process has been very Byzantine, very drawn out, and the final result will probably not come in until sometime after the Congress comes back from its August recess, in other words, after Labor Day. So amazingly, Congress will probably not respond to this in the quick way that many people might expect.
And we've been speaking with Paul Barrett, who is a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Paul, you've been doing a series of pieces on the lawsuits and about the gun industry in general. If people want to check out these articles that you've been doing, where can they go on the web?
They can go to the journal's website, which is WSJ.com, and you can find some or all of our pieces there.
Well,
unlike a lot of newspaper websites, though, ours, you need to pay to get it, most of our material.
It is the Wall Street Journal, after all.
That's right.
Well, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks. In this last segment of the program, talking about corporations and their power, we're going to turn to another issue, and that is the high-stakes internet battle that is erupting in San Francisco right now. It issues, should San Francisco require cable television companies to open high-speed networks to rival internet service providers, or should it take a hands-off approach? The combatants, telecommunications kingpin AT&T, and online giant America Online and its local telephone partners. Joining us right now to fight this issue out, which, though is erupting in San Francisco, is also a battle that's being waged in some cities as Portland, Miami, Los Angeles, is Peter Arnold, who's executive director of the Hands Off Internet Coalition, pro-AT&T group, and Jamie Love with the Consumer Project on Technology. Since we only have a few minutes, Jamie Love, can you lay out in very lay terms for even the Luddites among us what this battle is all about and what's happening specifically in San Francisco?
Well, as we go to a higher speed method of connecting the internet, the issue is the company that owns the pipe, that owns the wire that gives you the fast connection, can they control content or can they discriminate among content providers, people that want to provide this new generation of services? Can they make their affiliated services work better, easier to find, and things like that? San Francisco, Portland, cities in Florida, they're having to decide whether or not to force the cable companies to provide something more akin to what the phone systems do, which is to provide more of a common carrier platform so that any content provider can come in on equal terms or non-discriminatory terms.
Even content provider may be a term that people don't understand.
Well, there are two areas, I think, that will be important. One are things that you think of more like a TV show or a radio show or something like that, where you get a multimedia thing that you get over the internet, and the speed at which you get it, the level of reliability, all those things will be determined by services which AT&T will control. And AT&T wants to discriminate over whether, say, your radio program would get on the Fast Track platform or the Go Fast platform, or whether it would be kind of on the crummy platform. I mean, they want to be able to decide. The other area is e-commerce, because what TCI wants to do, or what AT&T wants to do, is control, just like Microsoft and other people do. They want to control what you see, what menus, when you want to buy flowers for your wife, when you want to buy a car, when you want to find a movie. They want to make it easier to go through their navigation devices and portals and ways of finding businesses and things than other people do. So that's what's at stake, is the attention of the consumer, control over how you find things on the internet, and the performance of the services that are provided.
As I said, we're also joined by Peter Arnold, who is with the pro-AT&T group, Hands Off the Internet Coalition. What do you see at issue, Mr. Arnold?
Well, Amy, I think the key thing in terms of the decision out of San Francisco was that the Board of Supervisors considered the arguments of the local phone monopolies and America Online. They also considered the arguments from AT&T and the cable companies. And I think the deciding factor was the weighing in of our nation's top regulators. For example, Chairman of the FCC, William Kennard, who came down strongly in favor of keeping government out of the area of regulating internet content. Chairman Kennard said, and I'm quoting here in a speech he gave about 2 weeks ago, "If we've learned anything about the internet in government over the last 15 years, it's that it's thrived quite nicely without the intervention of government." FCC Commissioner Michael Powell, a colleague of Chairman Kennard's, has dismissed the arguments that Mr. Love and the phone monopolies and AOL have made. He called them shallow. And so we see the Board of Supervisors vote as a vindication that entrepreneurs will still be able to compete, to develop new solutions, to bring new access to high-speed access to consumers without worrying about government regulation muddying up the waters.
And Jamie Love, how do you see the San Francisco Board of Supervisors' decision this week?
Well, I think they put off the difficult decisions, and it just means they're going to consider it further. It's a bit of a go-slow approach. this idea that people don't want the government to regulate the internet and control it is really kind of a demagogic thing that AT&T is saying. What AT&T is saying is, let us control the internet, let us decide, let us regulate it, let us pick winners and losers. Don't let that bad thing the government come in, but what all the consumer groups, the national consumer groups that have worked on these issues in a united front have all said is that it's the government's role to protect competition and to protect equal access of people that want to provide services over the internet to these people that control monopolistic things like the last mile, the way of getting fast internet connections. And what we want the government to do is not to avoid the tough problems, not to avoid the tough issues, but to do its job, which is to protect the public against monopolies. And in this case, if AT&T controls the pipe and they can control the content, it's going to be a disaster as far as the future of competition on the internet.
Peter Arnold.
Amy, may I break in for just a second? You kind of wonder where to begin with a comment like that. Let's start by saying something that Jamie and I might just agree with, and that is that the race to provide consumers with high-speed internet access, always-on access, is one of the most furiously competitive in America right now. Just look at the players you have out there. You've got AOL teaming up with the local phone monopolies. You've got Mindspring teaming up with Bell South. And that's for DSL service. In terms of cable, you have AT&T and Time Warner racing to develop their system. In terms of satellite, it's America Online, again, teaming up with Hughes Electronics and DirecTV. They're trying to create a satellite approach to it. Intel, just last week, announced they were trying to produce, or they would begin producing, what they call a fast modem. There's also wireless. The utility companies are racing to develop their own system to bring internet access in via the electricity wire. So we have a phenomenal amount of competition here, and I think what we've been saying, and also what Chairman Kennard has said, and Michael Powell has said, is that with all this competition, consumers are best off by letting the marketplace run with it, and some will win and some will lose. But that's the nature of the free market. I just want to point out to your listeners one item that might be of interest. There is. Mr. Love is right about one thing. There is a lot of demagoguery about this. Let me just read to you one quote from a senior official at the nation's largest internet service provider, America Online. Less than a year ago, he declared, and I'm quoting here, "The vast majority of our customers have no need for access speeds that are any greater than 28.8. Now, you know, what this is really about is the effort by the phone monopolies and by America Online to get the government in to make amends for their own really bad business decisions. They did not think consumers wanted this high-speed internet access. Consumers do. AOL and the phone monopolies are behind the eight ball. I just read you that quote, which is pretty clear about it, and cable has made the business decision. They made it a couple of years ago to invest in this network. They're now ready to reap the benefits of it. AOL and the phone monopolies are scrambling to catch up.
Can I just respond to one of the problems?
Jamie Love.
Right now, there are two ways that your technologies that are feasible, really, to get high-speed access to the Internet. One is through the phone company systems, these DSL-type technologies. The other is just the cable thing. The phone system is currently regulated as a common carrier platform, and they have to provide access to their network to their competitors. And anyone, including AT&T, if they want to get access to the phone network, has a framework, a poorly regulated framework, but a framework which, when in theory, they're supposed to be doing it. So the fact that you have competition on the DSL front, some of what the competitors he mentioned, is precisely because the government has this regulatory framework. Now the phone companies are saying, if AT&T is not regulated, we want deregulation parity. And so a consequence of AT&T winning on this deregulated, we own the pipe, we can control the content, just like they've done on cable for years, where they demand ownership of content providers for placement on their cable systems. If they succeed in that, then the phone companies are going to say that we want to do the same thing on the phone side, and you'll have a duopoly. It's true, you'll have two, but you know, basically two people, big, huge corporate entities, and you will destroy the whole idea of an open platform.
On that note, we have to wrap up. Jamie Love of the Consumer Project on Technology and Peter Arnold with AT&T, the group, Hands Off the Internet Coalition. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Suzette Ermler. Our engineer today is Matthew Finch, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!